Thompson.
On the show today, we're talking all things finance and tax when it comes to your investment. Welcome to Property Matters. Welcome along to another Monday. We've hit August. It's time we start thinking about that Christmas holiday bookings and all those important things as the year is just racing past us. Now, this week, we're absolutely delighted for us to sort of delve into the financial sort of, I guess, tax and accounting world when it comes to investments. So a big welcome to Anthony Strevens, who is part of Gillian Rowe and Associates. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Are you one of the associates?
Yeah, I am. I am a partner at GRA at Gilligan Rowe & Associates.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And just talk to us a little bit about the sort of kind of clients and things that you work with.
Yeah, cool. So GRA is a sort of a mid-tier practice in Newmarket. And so our clients would generally be small to medium enterprises or high net worth people with property investments. So we very much specialise in accounting for property investment, whether that's developments or buy to holds or property trading, flipping, all that kind of thing. That's really our cup of tea. And of course, the people that get involved in property aren't always just in property. They get their money from somewhere, and so often that's small to medium businesses as well, and so we're heavily involved in accounting for them as well. So, and that's, you know, your financial statements, tax returns, GST, all those sort of periodic taxes, as well as your forecasting and budgeting and so on and so forth, yeah.
Nice. Now, because of the nature of your work, I'm going to sort of let you do a bit of a disclaimer here, because you kind of got to protect your industry in this space.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess all we need to cover there is that whatever we go over today is not financial advice, and it's not tax advice either. Everybody needs to really get their own financial and tax advice, because it's always going to be bespoke to their particular situation and their circumstances. But, you know, if they are wanting to get that advice, then they can come along to GRA, and we are always happy to give anybody a free initial meeting to see where they sit, what their structure's like, what their goals are, and what we can do to help them with that.
Brilliant. What drew you into this career and specialising in property and investor focus sort of side of things, but also just this whole career path?
Funnily enough, a lot of it's just by accident, putting one foot in front of the other. I didn't actually study accounting at university. I did a commerce degree, but it majored in international business and IT, of all things.
Okay.
I ended up moving up to Kerikeri, and I got a job at an accounting firm because there weren't too many different places to apply my commerce skills up there. And from there, I spent about 3 years and maybe 4 years in Northland and started studying a bit of accounting because I thought, why not if I'm going to be working at it? And finally ended up getting a qualification as a chartered accountant. And then my wife and I moved back to Auckland, and I got a job at GRA. And in fact, that's where I've been for 15 years, coming up in 16 years perhaps at GRA. And so I wasn't always necessarily into property, but after 15 or 16 years at a property accounting firm, you know, you tend to get a vibe for these things. And of course, during that time, become a property investor myself, as are all the partners at GRA. Yeah, that's kind of been my career journey to date, I guess.
That's cool. That's cool. What have you seen has been, you know, the most significant changes for property investors in New Zealand, you know, over, say, the last decade?
I think I would say two things there. I think the change in the market, you know, you go back 10 years, very buoyant market. Mm-hmm. Then 5 years ago, we were kind of in COVID, but you were just at the beginning or perhaps in the middle or thereabouts of the COVID boom. You know, 5 or 10 years ago, there were capital gains all over.
Right.
Whereas now, we're in a quite different market, aren't we? You know, it's been flat for quite a few years. And so the capital gain side of things isn't quite there for the investors that it used to be as a default. The other thing, and we'll get into this a lot later, I guess, is all the tax changes, right? So first it started with a bright line and then loss ring fencing and then interest deductibility and successive governments have tried to stem the rampant growth in the property market with tax policy, which is, as we all know, really now it's not particularly effective or wasn't particularly effective. So I think that's the two things, the biggest changes. Because it used to be, you know, 10 years ago, if you just had a rental property, your accounting was extremely simple. But now you're dealing, if your expenses are more than your income, then your losses are ring-fenced. And, you know, up until just recently, only a certain proportion of your interest could be deducted. And the complexity of it is really increased.
What do you see are the most common mistakes that new investors are making when they, you know, first come and see you?
I think that comes down to structure. People haven't considered their ownership structure for their investment and how that's going to fit in with the other things that they do, whether or not they're a salaried employee or whether or not they are in business, what other assets they might have. And so they haven't got the advice at the beginning of their journey or when they've made a large purchase or successive purchases to get their structure correct. I think that's probably the biggest mistake. I would say, and this is a slight conflict of interest here, or is that they're trying to do their tax themselves.
I was just going to say, well, I could segue that because I was going to say, do you think people come to the professionals too late? Sometimes does it take something going wrong before we go, oh, I need help?
Yeah, I think
it's
can
that
do
Kiwi it. DIY. I can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's people that come along who have done it right as well.
Great.
You know, in terms of filing their tax returns.
Yeah.
And certainly there's plenty of people that have also got that wrong. And I think more so recently, just because of all these sorts of changes and add-ons to tax policy that we've had over the last few years, which have complicated the filing of what should be a reasonably straightforward thing.
Right. Let's look now at asset protection, and let's start with structure. Why does getting it right at the beginning make such a difference?
And I think it's because structure, and you might not think this when someone gives you a quote for setting up your structure, but it's actually cheaper to fix at the outset. It's cheaper to get it right at the beginning.
Right.
Than it is to fix as you go along. So it might cost you a couple of grand to set up a trust or $800 to set up a company or something like that at the beginning. But if you get things wrong or the wrong way around, then moving assets, particularly property, has tax issues like triggering bright line or depreciation recovery or GST if it's a trade property or a development. So getting things right at the outset can help you to get your asset protection sorted and also helps with tax efficiency.
When people say, you know, separating risk from wealth, what does that actually look like in practice?
So I guess risk is anything generating a claim against you. So that's trading risk, employing people, contracting, entering into agreements with business partners, taking on debt. Those are aspects of risk. And of course, there's also just personal day-to-day risk. You know, just as you're walking around, you might cause some sort of financial distress to someone that you then have to reparate them for. So those are the risks. And wealth is what you want to protect. So the family home, your rentals, a share portfolio if you have one, retained capital in your company. And so separating them is about ensuring that those risks, if they come to bear, don't affect the wealth.
Right. So is the ideal setup then having the trading activity in one entity and holding property in another?
Yep, absolutely. So so I think the principle of that side of things hasn't changed. So trading in a company, property assets held separately, usually in a trust, is still where it's at, you know. What's changed from time to time is the tax overlay. So right now I've got 39% trust tax rate, and that's the same as the top personal rate, and a 28% company rate. And that shifts the flavour of the holding entity that you might have depending on your particular scenario, where you sit and what assets you hold. So the answer to how you might separate that risk and wealth might be different for everyone depending on what they're doing.
And where does the good old family home sit in all of this?
The good old family home sits in the good old family trust.
Right.
Yeah. So, and that sort of is the mainstay of any good asset protection structure, is a safe harbour family trust.
Okay. So let's unpack this whole trust discussion, because they're often talked about as a protection tool. You know, what do they actually protect against, and what, I guess, what don't they protect against?
So a well set up trust protects probably against most things most of the time.
Okay.
And that's probably an important point, is to say that trusts aren't a be all and end all, and they are not bulletproof. And so you'll often hear people say, oh, well, you know, I don't, you know, I got told that trusts aren't any good anymore. And often that advice comes from someone that's looking at something from a very black and white point of view. Like,
right.
You know, is that trust going to protect me perfectly all the time? And the answer is not if you don't run it well. And even then, you're subject to a court. If you're, if you've got a creditor or someone coming after you, and decisions
right.
made in court. So, but what it is a great tool that puts you in the right position to protect your assets as best you can in those situations. And so if I've got a creditor coming after me and I own everything personally, and the court says, oh, you've got to pay up, I've got to sell those assets and pay up. If all my assets are owned in a trust and I've managed that in effective ways so that I don't, the trust doesn't owe me any money or anything like that, there's no connections there, then I'm in a much stronger position to negotiate a settlement of some sort. So these things are really, it comes down to the practical realities, and as opposed to the black and whites. So what do they protect against? They can protect against business failure, you know, creditors, third-party claims. What don't they protect against? Well, they don't protect against, you know, if you've got a debt that's owned in the trust and a guarantee with the bank. Well, of course, you know, that's up for grabs, right? They don't protect you against your own conduct as a trustee, And I think we'll get to this as well a bit later. The relationship property side of things, you know, it's not always a way that you might protect assets from a relationship property claim if they're joint assets like a family home. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
What about personal guarantees? They seem to undo a lot of structuring. You know, how big of a risk are they, and can it realistically be avoided?
Yeah, so personal guarantees would be wonderful if we could all avoid personal guarantees, but that's certainly never going to be the case when it comes to bank debt, right? You know, I mean, the bank relies on your capacity to service loans, and so that's why you're always going to have to provide a personal guarantee when you want to get debt to buy investment property. But I think what a lot of people don't necessarily realise on that side of things with the personal guarantees and the securities that they agree to with banks is that a bank will ask you to, I want to cross-secure all your assets and a personal guarantee from you against everything. And a lot of people will look at that and go, oh, well, I guess that's what I have to do to get this debt. But actually, you're probably able to change that slightly with a bit of negotiation. So limiting facilities, avoiding all obligations and cross guarantees. And that's, again, going back to the trust thing, I suppose, where, you know, if you can do get a split bank lending sort of scenario whereby you might have some debt with one bank and some debt with another bank, and those debts are in different structures. Now, you'll still have to provide the personal guarantee probably on both those scenarios.
Yep.
But that just comes back to you personally. And if you don't own those assets because they're well set up within your trust structure, then you've given the personal guarantee, but maybe it's not going to bite you too badly in a worst-case scenario.
How do these structures all hold up in a relationship property situation, especially, you know, blended families these days?
Of course, if you're looking at relationship property stuff, you need a relationship property lawyer. Mm. But from the trust side of things, they can fit in well with the relationship property, and you know you'll want a contracting out agreement, which is a prenup. You know, because that's the be all and end all of relationship property is having one of those agreements, because that essentially dictates how things are going to work. If you don't have that, then it just sort of falls back to the Relationship Property Act, which is pretty much 50-50. But if you've had a trust set up beforehand, then and that trust has separate property and none of your relationship earnings or anything like that went into that property, then that's probably a stronger position to say, well, that belongs to that person as opposed to the other person. With the blended families things, that can get difficult because if you've got someone that passes away, right, like blended family, ooh, right? So what is a blended family? It's a mum and a dad, or it could be a mum and a mum or a dad and a dad, of course, and they've got kids from previous relationships and they come together. But then if one of them passes away, if all their assets go to their spouse and then those assets then go down to that spouse's kids and the person that passed away's kids isn't left with anything, so it can be... So it's important to consider that sort of thing and ensure that you've got the right documents in place and the right structures and instructions for your future trustees and whatnot to ensure that that kind of situation is dealt with. And maybe that's also a thing like, you know, if there's any... because blended families could be older parents with adult children, right?
Yeah,
so if there's any of those adult children listening now thinking about that, you know, you tap mum or dad on the shoulder and say, have you thought about this?
Yeah. Do you see those family trusts protecting in a normal sort of marriage breakup separation scenario, not blended, just normal scenario?
I suppose most of the time the normal scenario is that family set up a trust and it is all just relationship property, so it's not really a thing to protect.
Right.
It's, you know, because they're just going to, you know, sell the assets and split it up and dissolve that trust.
Yeah.
And then go their own way and perhaps set up new trusts.
Where do contracting out of agreements sort of fit into this picture?
Yeah, so that's the prenup agreement.
Right.
So that's where, you know, you come in and maybe someone's already got some assets and the other person doesn't, or someone's got some rental properties and someone's got some inheritance and they want to say, well, we're going to come into this relationship and what we come in with is what we'll leave with plus perhaps half of everything we create together or something like that. That would be, I think, quite a common sort of scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you explain the role of EPAs and the memorandums of wishes in protecting families and assets?
Yeah, so an EPA, an enduring power of attorney, is a legal agreement. And again, you know, you get these drawn up by lawyers and whatnot, but generally split into property and personal care and welfare. So property EPA would be whereby someone's sort of lost capacity for their own finances, and the power of attorney will work for them. So in my family, my mother unfortunately is in dementia care, and so her EPA has been activated and my father deals with her finances. And also for the same reason, her personal care and welfare power of attorney is activated and my father makes decisions about, you know, like her nurses will ask him about medications and things like that, make those decisions. So, and then a memorandum of wishes, quite different. Memorandum of wishes is kind of like a will, but for a trust. It's whereby the people that set up the trust go, well, these are my wishes for what happens to this trust if I pass away, if I'm not around to sort things out. And it's not binding, but it's guidance for the people that are coming. And I suppose if you put this all together, that's your estate planning set of documents, and it's really important to keep these things current, and it's really kind to have these things in place for the next generations, so that they know what your wishes are and they've got the facilities required to deal with them if you pass away.
Yeah. So important to have that will kept up to date.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well.
Yeah. That's right. Because, I mean, I know for a while there, my father was still the executor for my will up until quite recently. And he'd still be reasonably capable of it right now.
Yeah.
But you know, like if we got hit by the same bus, for example, or something like that, which I suppose could happen in any case with someone with a particular executor, but it's a, you know, you can have a situation where if you don't keep things up to date, then they don't make sense. Yeah.
Okay. So let's now talk about tax issues for property investors. How do you choose between owning property in your own name, LTC, a company, a trust? Where do all those sit?
So what works best, again, it's a bespoke situation for each person based on their circumstances. All of those are viable options for owning rental properties. Personal ownership's very simple. You know, it's probably still the most common ownership, really, structure, because people will go and go, oh, well, I'm going to buy a rental property, and they'll go through the process of doing that and buying it. And if they don't go get advice about how they might structure it, then by default, it's going to be in their own name.
Right.
Which is nice and simple and cheap, but you're subject to your top marginal tax rate, if depending on how much you earn. There's no protection from creditors. There's no flexibility. All of the profit will be taxed in your name. LTCs, you hear this term LTC, right, which means look-through company. And something that people don't often get is that an LTC is actually just an ordinary company, but it has elected to be called or treated as an LTC with Inland Revenue. So if there's profits or losses, that flows through to the shareholders rather than taxed at company level. And they used to be very popular when you could offset losses against your income. But now we have ring fencing and you can't do that anymore. So they've lost some of their flair from a tax planning point of view. But they still have their place in certain circumstances. Trusts, of course. Trusts are great for protection. So, again, it really comes down to your personal situation, and it might be quite a different answer for a person with one property versus a person with 10 rental properties.
And I guess that was my next question. You know, is there a trigger point that you decide, okay, the one property versus multiple, where I should be switching which way I structure this?
Yeah. No one right answer, but okay. Of course, the more property you own, I guess the more it makes sense to have some decent structure around it. I'd even say that for one property, but you know, if you've got, for example, a property portfolio that's making taxable profits, then having the company tax rate of 28% can be quite beneficial if you're otherwise subject to the top personal rate of 39%. And that can make a difference over a space of time, because if you can take 11% of your profits and funnel that back into paying down debt, you know, that has a real advantage over time. You know, that compounding of debt reduction can be powerful. So getting that right is a can be quite powerful. But at the same time, you need to do the cost-benefit analysis. If you've got a structure that saves $2,000 of tax, but it costs you $3,500 every year to maintain, that doesn't make sense.
Also important, I was in a room of property managers today talking about different laws, and of course it's important to note that tenancy laws are different depending who is the named or type of named owner on a tenancy agreement. For example, if you're wanting to give 42 days notice to move into the property, you can only do that if you're an individual owner, not an LTC, not a trust, and not a company.
Right.
Yeah, so making sure that you're always checking out all those little loopholes there. When it comes to maximising deductions, what can investors realistically claim? And where do you see people getting this wrong?
Yeah, it's pretty it's pretty straightforward, I think, really. There's no magic bullets or secret stashes of expenses you can claim that some people know about and others don't, you know. Your rates, insurance, interest, 100% we can claim that now. Or at least for the next few months anyway, depending on election results. Property management, fees, repairs and maintenance, depreciation on chattels. So, you know, all these things that you incur in the course of running the rental property or the compliance of it will generally be deductible expenses. I suppose one of the big ticket items which people get wrong is the difference between deductible repairs and maintenance or expenditure that is incurred to improve the property. And there's a lot of analysis required there in terms of whether or not the 15 grand renovation is a repair or maintaining the property, or whether or not you've actually improved it beyond its original condition. And I think that's an interesting point, because I think people and even tax practitioners can sometimes be a bit too conservative there. Of course, the property owner themselves always wants to claim every dollar. But I think when you, or actually, in fact, when you're deciding whether or not something is repairs and maintenance, you have to go through a two-step process. The first thing is you have to identify the asset. And the asset that you're talking about is a building. It's a big asset. So, you know, improving it, you know, you, especially if it's a rental, right? You go in and you replace a kitchen, for example. You're going in and you're placing it with some flat pack Bunnings kitchen or whatnot, and a simple tabletop. It's probably like for like with what was there before, reasonably speaking. And a lot of people will say, "Right, but that what was there before was old and tired, and I'm." What's there now looks nice and new, but actually, is it an improvement, or is it just a like for like? And probably, what was there before was cabinetry that was handcrafted by someone in the 1980s. You've probably reduced the quality of what's gone in.
That is interesting. Is restructuring debt something investors should actively be considering right now?
Restructuring debt is something investors should always actively consider.
Yeah.
And particularly it's an opportunity when you have private debt. So if you've got a big home loan and but an unencumbered or a rental property with no loan against it, you need to look at how you can change that, because you want that interest that you're paying to be tax deductible. And so restructuring and how you go about it is important. You can't just go and do it for a tax purpose. That would be tax avoidance to restructure. It's purely for the purpose of interest. But what's interesting there, and what people sometimes don't really pick up, is that the better reason for restructuring debt is often asset protection. Because, like, if you've got a big mortgage against the home but not against the rental, then all your equity is sitting in the rental. You're better off with all your equity sitting in your home and your family trust and that safe harbour trust. So, because that's where you're going to get the best asset protection. So often you get an incidental or a great tax advantage out of doing the smart asset protection move.
Can you break down rental loss ring fencing and what happens to those losses when a property is sold?
Yeah, so if you have expenses that are, or more expenses than you have rental income, then you've got a loss and you've got excess, what they call excess rental deductions. And so it used to be, like I was saying with the LTCs, you could offset them against your income and people get tax refunds. Can't do that anymore. So now those expenses get carried forward. They don't get lost. They don't go into oblivion. You get to carry them forward. And even if you sell your rental property, you still get to carry them forward. And they can still be offset against future rental income if you have it in the future. So no more offsets, you know, you can't get those tax refunds, but maybe at some stage you still get the benefit of the expenditure.
Now, the infamous bright line test, it's now back to 2 years, but that doesn't mean you're in the clear, does it?
Yeah, the bright line test was sort of a catch, trying to catch people that were genuinely speculating. That's a word that gets thrown around about a lot of property investors, but and it was only ever an addition to the laws that already existed. So we often talk about there being no capital gains tax in New Zealand, but there is a lot of ways in which your capital gains can be taxed in property. If you firstly, if you bought with the intention of resale, but if you've subdivided within 10 years of ownership or a major subdivision, if you've had a zoning change, if you've had a consent issued in between buying and selling, it can be taxed. And all those things still exist. So, yep, bright line's back to 2 years, but there's lots of other ways that you could be taxed. And it's important to figure out whether or not any of those might apply to you, and that's where good advice comes into it, because otherwise, you know, you don't want to get found a couple of years down the track that Inland Revenue comes knocking on the door and saying, oh, you know what, that sale was actually taxable, and the money's nowhere to be seen, and then you suddenly interest and penalties accrue, and it's a quick way to get into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Moving away from the usual investment property, what about those that have short stays, like Airbnb scenarios? What are some of the biggest tax traps, especially around GST and those mixed-use asset rules?
Yeah, cool. So with the short stay stuff, with Airbnbs, your rental income is subject to GST, and this is the GST trap, and it's... it's an important thing to understand, because if your total income from Airbnbs, and this is specific to one entity, so maybe one company has two Airbnbs and the total income goes over $60,000 for the year or any year, not just a tax year, you're deemed to be GST registered. And if you're GST registered, then the asset that you're using in that business becomes, it falls into the GST net.
Right.
And those are big assets. We're talking properties,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Now, it could be that you get to go and claim GST, possibly, on your purchase price. But if that was a family batch that was purchased for $50,000 in 1980, and you're now Airbnb-ing it, and then you want to go and sell it in 3 years' time for $1.5 million, because that's what's happened to coastal property, you've got to pay GST on that 1.5. So that's 15% of $1.5 million because you were Airbnb-ing and went over that 60 grand. So that's a big, that's a big gotcha. You don't want that one. Mixed-use asset rules, that's just where you've got like a holiday home, right? And you use it privately as well, so it's It's rented and it's also private usage, so there's mixed use, and there's some rules that mean that you can't claim all your expenses. You've got to apportion them. And there's another one of those complicated sort of things which, if you've got that scenario, you're better off with an accountant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Financials for that one.
Oh, my goodness, Anthony. I have so many more questions for you, but not enough time. I think you're going to have to be a repeat guest later in the year. But I'm very conscious that the general election is coming up. How are you seeing the main parties positioning themselves on property investment?
Well, there's some parties that are positioning on property investment and others that are all for the status quo. So the current National Party government aren't looking at making many changes at all. But the big ticket item, I guess, that's in the headlines is the capital gains tax from Labor, which would be on residential and commercial property and applies to gains from 1 July 2027. So how that would work is that on 1 July 2027, everybody has to go out and get their property valued. So if Labor gets in, I might go and retrain as a valuer because I'm going to get a lot of business suddenly come July 2027. So basically, though, what that means is that all your gains up to that point are locked in on the prior scenario, that they're essentially tax-free, I suppose, unless some other legislation applies. Which we were just talking about. So that's the Labor scenario. And then the likes of course, the new kids on the block, the Opportunity Party, which are you allowed to say that on radio?
Yeah.
I think
we're not doing a political broadcast. Asking your feedback.
All over social media, everybody seems to be so angry that they're getting so much life in the media. But they've of course got that land tax scenario of whatever, 1.75% on the value of your land, and then the Greens wealth tax. Yeah, 2% wealth, I think over 10 million, something like that, yeah. So there's a lot of potential changes, and, you know, it's just, I guess it's more of the same as far as it goes for property investors. There's constant change, and it's a real political football.
Yeah. And I guess for accountants like yourself, it's staying up to date with the constant change.
It is staying up to date with the constant change, and it's, you know what? It's not bad for business. So, you know, maybe I'd, at the risk of promoting, go for the change parties and then come and get your accounting done.
Get some support.
Yeah.
Why do you think good records and valuations are so critical, regardless of sort of what happens politically?
Just keeping up to date with where you sit and what your balance sheet is and your capacity for refinancing is key to any investment and key to any investor moving forward. Yeah.
One quick takeaway. What's one thing every property investor should check in or fix for the next 12 months?
We were talking about personal guarantees. Figure out what you've personally guaranteed.
Right.
Like, I think a lot of people don't know what they might have signed on, especially business owners. Maybe personal property securities register. Get your lawyer to have a look at that for you and call your bank and say, give me a list of my guarantees. You might be surprised.
Wow.
Yeah.
Frightening. How can people get in touch with you and your company to look at their own structure and get their tax sorted or just get some good advice from you and your team?
Well, we're on most socials and we have, of course, a website, www.gra.co.nz. And once you're on there, you'll be able to follow your nose and find yourself in the right place to get a free initial meeting with us and come in and speak with many of our consultants, and I'm one of those. We can see where you're at and how we can help.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. You've unpacked that so well today and in plain English for our listeners. I really appreciate it. Like I said, we had a million other questions, so you'll have to come back.
Yeah, I feel like we didn't get through even half the content that we thought we might. Yeah.
That is cool. Thank you so much, yes, Anthony, for coming on. Have a fabulous week, everybody. Make sure you're driving safe, keeping warm. We will catch you next Monday here on Planet FM. And remember, you can download us from all your favourite podcast sites, Apple and Samsung, iHeartRadio, you name it, we're there, and on Spotify. Have a great week. Take care.